Hey guys, welcome back to Campaign War Stories. I'm Wesley Donahue, and this is the podcast where we talk to folks in politics about the insanity that is campaign life. Today, I had the pleasure of talking to Republican pollster Jim Hobart of Public Opinion Strategies. We talked about how polling has changed over the last decade and where it's heading. All right, brother, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. You in D.C. today?
I am. Alexandria, other side of the river.
Nice. Well, how's my boy Glenn Bulger doing?
He's doing well. He just got back from Asia, actually. So he's reacclimating.
Nice. Glenn is the very first pollster I ever worked with in my career.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
he used to do a bunch of South Carolina. He did DeMint and then a bunch of state legislative stuff down there too. That's probably where you worked with him.
That's exactly right. In my youth, I did a bunch of state legislative races, but you know, we didn't have money for actually polling in those kind of races. You know, that we basically just used ID work and kind of figured out what was going on from there. And it wasn't until I started working on the DeMint campaign with Terry Sullivan, who we were talking about before we hit record. That I actually was on a campaign big enough to have a pollster. And the very first one I ever met in my life was Glenn Bulger.
No, that's great.
So I got to get him on this podcast at some point.
Exactly. I know he'd love that.
So how did you get into politics, man?
So it's probably a little bit of a similar story to yours. So I'm from Atlanta, and I was living in Atlanta, working at just a first job out of college that I didn't love. And I always knew that politics was an interest of mine. So I just broken up with the girl and I said, you know what, I'm going to quit this job and I need to get into politics, right? It's something I've always wanted to do, but didn't have much political on my resume, but knew there was a special election. This is in 2007 in Augusta. So like 2.5 hours from Atlanta. And I knew some folks who were working on it. It was the special election for Charlie Norwood Seat, who had passed away. And so I moved there and worked for the Jim Whitehead campaign. It was like endorsed by all the right people, establishment favorite. And I worked for free with the idea that, hey, you know, if you work for him, he's going to win. And then you'll get to move to DC and be like his legislative correspondent or something. So it's a special. So it's a jungle primary, 8 Republicans, 2 Democrats, 1 Libertarian running. We have 44% the first time. But it's Georgia. So it's a runoff state. So we go to our runoff against a guy named Paul Brown. And long story short, we end up losing him about 350 votes, so which was a shock to all of us, obviously. So I am just crushed. I brought my mom for the victory party. Like, mom, thanks for supporting me while I work on this campaign for like 4 months. You know, we lose it. I'm literally in tears. But it was a great experience. It was good to learn how hard people have to work on campaigns. And then I moved to D.C., and lived on friends' couches for like 3 weeks, interviewing for jobs, still thinking that I wanted to work on the Hill. Interviewed for some jobs on the Hill, interviewed for a job here at Public Opinion Strategies, and this was the first job that I got offered. Wasn't crazy about it. I never thought that polling was something I wanted to do, but my parents said, look, if you want to live in D.C., you've got to have a job. So I took this job with the intention of working for the 2008 cycle, and then, okay, then I'm going to go and get a job on the Hill, which is what I thought I wanted. Yeah. Well, it's 17-ish years later, I'm still here and I'm a partner. And it ended up being a really good fit. And I'm lucky enough to love what I do, love the people I work with. So it's a happy story.
Oh, man, that victory party reminds me of my very first date with my wife. I took her to a victory party and ended up losing and was pretty embarrassed by that. But then we went over to congratulate the guy that beat us. And he asked me to come run his campaign here in the general election. So it ended up being
at
night. 19 years later, I'm married to the girl. So that right. Ended up okay. So that's interesting that you like your first real job outside of that first campaign was with POS. And then you know you just fell into it really by accident. What was the first job you were given over there?
Research. We called it at the time research assistant. Now it's research analyst, which is entry-level job. Really what the RA does is they put together the slide decks, the PowerPoints that we show to our clients is the bulk of it. So started from the bottom and worked my way up. And it was 2008 was tough too, because the big campaign we were working on was Norm Coleman for Senate. So lost that one by 312 votes. So it's like, oh my God, you know, is every campaign I work on just going to be a heartbreaker? But then in 2009, we got to work on the McDonald campaign, which was a great win. And so that one, it was my first big win that I got to be a small part of. And so always holds a special place in my heart.
How did you learn? Were they destined for osmosis?
Yeah, no. So it was Glenn and the other partners here do a great job of really showing you the ropes of, because they want people to be successful, especially if they show somewhat of an affinity for bowling, which I did. You know, we've got now 11 partners, and I think all but one have started working as a staffer, right? So we've got a big culture of promoting from within. And so they did a great job of being like, hey, you're a good RA. Now you're going to be what's called a project director. You're going to be what we call a vice president. And then partner about 4 or 5 years ago.
Because it seems to me, I ask that question because polling to me is one of the more difficult parts of politics. And did you already have a strong basis background in math and statistics?
So I'd always been a big sports fan. And so knew statistics just from like liking baseball and liking football and thinking about it from that perspective. You know, was always pretty good at math, but our firm has the approach that the most important, or one of the most important parts of polling, is understanding how to write and message. So if you come to us with the ability to write and message, we can teach you the math part, right? The statistical part. Because a lot of that, frankly, computers can do it, right? You're plugging things to Excel. Other firms are different. They have with the statistics background, and it will teach you the writing part. But like me, I was a liberal arts major in college. It's not like I have a PhD in statistics or anything like that.
Interesting. So I always kind of thought that polling was the more, I guess the only word I could use is scholarly part of politics, if that makes sense. Because I just know that I couldn't be good at polling because I am not a math guy, right? Like,
right.
The moment I changed my major from engineering to political science is when I failed calculus too. And the only class I ever failed in any of my, you know, middle school, high school, college, the only thing I ever failed was a math class. And I knew at that point I did not want a career based in math. But to do politics, you have at least the ability to interpret math, which is what I could do with polling. But that doesn't mean I could actually do what you do. I just feel like I have a liberal arts background too. I guess what I'm saying is you might not be giving yourself enough credit, because I don't know a lot of people that could just dive in and do what you do.
Well, yeah, it's been 17 years and I'm still learning every day. So.
Well, you know, to that point, what I do on the digital side, I have to continuously be learning because things are changing so damn rapidly, right? And as soon as you think you learn something, something new comes out. You know, just the other day, I did my demo on the Apple Vision Pro, thinking I better buy this $4,000 device now because this is going to be the next thing that I have to learn. So digital moves really fast, but polling is moving rapidly too for the same exact reasons, you know, social media, texting. How have you guys adapted over the last few years? Because you've been doing this 17 years, you've seen a massive shift from landlines to texting and social media. You know, in a minute, I want to look to the future, but what has that last, let's just say, decade looked like?
Yeah, so it's really been kind of two steps, right? So when I started, we were still 100% landline in 2008. In 2010, we moved to 20% cell phones, and it's been an increase every year. Now we're essentially at between 80 to 90% cell phone interviews when we do a 100% phone survey. But we're doing fewer and fewer of those. Now, whenever I do a proposal, I'm almost always giving clients the option for, hey, you can do 100% phones, or you can do what we call hybrid, you know, X percent in a live interview, X percent text to web. And that is something that we started doing in 2022. And in 2024, there's even more of it for a couple of reasons. One is it's helpful in reaching some harder to reach audiences. And then two, frankly, it's less expensive. You know, phone interviewing has become incredibly expensive to the point where even congressional, I mean, you talked at the outset, hey, state legislative campaigns can't afford it. Now it's challenging for even a congressional campaign to afford it. You know, if you're raising $400,000 to $500,000 for a congressional candidate, you know, you should maybe only be doing one poll just in terms of how you're allocating your congressional budget. And that's a great fundraising year for a congressional candidate. So that's what we've seen is more and more moving to that text-to-web. The social media stuff, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who are doing social, what they call social listening, right? To see what is what's percolating out there. I think that's useful. I think that's more helpful for either a really high-profile campaign or for someone who's already an incumbent, right? Like, hey, like I know you do Lindsey Graham's work. To be like, okay, let's do some social listening on Facebook to see what folks are saying about Lindsey Graham for a, you know, for an open seat congressional race. You could do that, but people aren't really talking about any of the candidates in any type of meaningful way.
Yeah, and we actually was doing a bunch of social listening. I think what we really used it a lot was with SeaWorld. But what I found is it's really only effective on listening to Twitter, right? And because of the closed nature of some of the other social platforms, because of privacy, you can't necessarily read people's Instagram or read people's Facebook accounts. You can really only read their Twitter accounts. And I find that Twitter is not representative of the normal populace, right? So you're really
not at all.
Yeah. So you're not really getting a good view with the social listening tools. Is the text to web as effective as a live?
So the one limitation to text to web is we are still very, very hesitant and strongly recommend not using it when you're doing your big like Oppo benchmarks, right? Where you're testing a bunch of the negative messages against both yourself and your opponent, because it's just so easy to screenshot that and say, hey, you know, then it ends up on a blog or on Twitter or something like that. So that is that's the drawback to it. I think it works well for when you're doing a pretty simple survey. I think when you're doing things for a corporate client or a public affairs client, it's pretty helpful. But we are still saying, hey, because there's nothing worse. Because it's happened. There's nothing worse than you're in the field like night two and your client emails you like, hey, our opponent just posted this screenshot of all the negative messages we're testing against him, WTF. Yeah. And it's like, hey, sorry, there's nothing we can do to prevent that. A screenshot. So that's a limitation. It also skews a little bit higher educated, right? Folks with a college degree who are already the most likely to pick up the phone are also more likely to respond to a text message survey. So that's still the most challenging people to reach are lower income, lower educated voters, which has obviously become a big challenge because that makes up a larger and larger portion of the Republican coalition and especially the Trump coalition.
Yeah, so it seems to me that the text to web would actually be a good tool for tracking.
Maybe. Yes, definitely.
Got it. So one question I have, it's because, you know, as political professionals, we like being polled, right? Like it's kind of fun, right? But the other day, I got on a Saturday at three polls last Saturday. Now, I live in South Carolina and we're in the middle of the South Carolina presidential primary. So it's not weird to be polled a lot. It was weird that I got three in one day. One was a live caller, two were texts, but one of the texts went so long that I just stopped. Like someone who's obsessed with politics, and I just stopped. I was like, enough of this shit. I'm going to go back to watching The Marvels on Disney Plus. And, you know, I'm 40, almost 45 years old. My attention span isn't as bad as a lot of people younger than me. And I find that attention spans are getting worse and worse. I mean, for us, 15-second ads are working better than even 30-second ads. And 60-second ads, we just can't even do them online anymore, to be honest with you, or rarely, unless there's like this really, really emotional hook. But I guess the question I'm getting to is like, how is the collapsing attention span changing the game for you guys, if at all?
It's a challenge, but it's not as much of a challenge as just getting people to pick up or respond. Once we get people to start taking a survey, we still have that success rate has held pretty steady. The difference is, whereas it used to take what we call our sample ratio, it used to be about 30-1. As meaning you needed to do 30 calls to get one interview. Now we're 150, 200, 250-1. So that's our biggest challenge. Once we get you on, you tend to complete the survey. Now, the caveat to that is what we have to be more careful about than we used to is when you're just sitting there hammering somebody with opposition messages, right? No longer can you test 10 different oppo messages with a single respondent. Instead, what we're doing is we're split-sampling, and maybe you're doing four or five with each respondent, and the other half get four or five, because then you do see people just get respondent fatigue and say, look, there's only so many times you can tell me this person
voted to allow a sex criminal out of jail early or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So we do have to be more careful about that.
Yeah, I know very few people who even pick up the phone these days if they don't know the phone number. So, but I got to imagine that text is really helping a lot. They'll, they see a text that's like, hey, you know, take this survey. They'll click on
that. Yeah, and that's the biggest difference, because we also do a lot of email-based surveys. And the biggest difference between an email-based survey and an online survey and a text-to-web survey is I tell people, look, think how many emails you delete without looking at them in a given day. Not to mention all the ones that get shuttled to your promotions or to your spam, but everybody opens their text messages, right? Like if you get a text, you look at it. And so that's one of the reasons why we moved to be, especially from a political standpoint, doing more and more of those.
Awesome. Awesome, man. But I appreciate you answering a bunch of those questions, because as the game changes, you know, with me and digital, I become obsessed. And what are the other guys doing? If we're seeing this on digital,
well, that's what I always think.
What are the male guys doing?
Right. The challenges of polling get a lot of attention because what we do is so public in terms of the results and things like that. But as I tell people, look, you know, my TV ad maker friends are having the same challenge. My digital friends are having the same, you know, it's just getting harder to reach people no matter what, no matter how you're trying to reach them.
You know, that's exactly the case. But the difference in what we do, what you do, is you don't have every major network doing what we do or every university trying to do what
exactly,
we
do.
Exactly,
yeah.
So it's just not
as I joke, as I joke, if I had to go back and do it all over again, I'd be a media buyer. It's easy. Just buy all of it, right? Yeah.
Well, as someone who does media buying, especially on the digital side, that's getting even more complicated. Well, we won't go into the fight we're having with all the TV firms right now. But...
Yeah, that'd be a longer podcast.
Oh, dude, yeah, it's insane. But, you know, in your 17 years, do you have like a favorite campaign you worked on or a favorite campaign war story?
So it's a good one is, you know, when you're the pollster, I've got a bunch of candidates that I've become friends with after I've worked with them. And there's only one instance where I was friends with somebody going in. A close friend, I'm godfather to his oldest daughter, decided to run for Congress in Texas in 2018. Open seat, great guy, former CIA agent. So he decides to run, but, you know, zero name ID, right? Never held elected office. So he decides to run, and it was clear that I was going to be the pollster, but I was going to be talking to him on the phone every day. I wasn't the general consultant by title or anything. There was someone who knew more about that type of stuff, but I was intimately involved in the campaign. So really three points that I'll always remember about this campaign that makes for somewhat decent stories, at least. So first one is we're watching everybody get in, and it's pretty positive, right? There's no awesome candidate. There's some state legislators or some like former county party chairs, but we're like, hey, you know, this is going to be pretty wide open. We're going to be in good shape. We knew we were going to have some success fundraising, so we weren't too worried about that. And then final day of filing, I'm getting off the plane in Miami, about to head to a wedding, and check Twitter, and I see that Chip Roy, who was Ted Cruz's chief of staff, file, which is not what you wanted to hear for a Texas seat, because, hey, guess what? Ted Cruz is very popular, and as you well know, when it's a Ted Cruz-related person, that doesn't just mean that Cruz isn't going to endorse. It means that the Club for Growth is likely to get involved, too, which means a lot of money. So it's like, oh, man, we got so close, but Chip's in. He's number one favorite immediately. But so campaign goes pretty well. We're hitting our fundraising marks. We make these great signs where we call them literally a terrorist hunter. It says William Negley, terrorist hunter. Those get a lot of earned media. We're up on TV and things are going well. It's looking like we're tracking to get into the runoff against Chip. And then the Thursday before the election, I'm out in Colorado doing some work for an energy client. I'm at a gas station in eastern Colorado in the rural area. And William calls me. He says, Hey, Jim, the Club for Growth just went up on the radio against me. It's like, what'd they go up on the radio with you about? He said that William Negley likes the idea of a third party challenger to in 2016 in the Hillary versus Trump race. I was like, what are they talking about? And this is, you know, William is CIA, so he'd gone back and like vetted his social media pretty carefully, right?
Yeah.
But what he hadn't done is checked the Twitter likes. And so literally liked a post that said something about the third party candidate. And that was enough for the club to run it. And he said, okay, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about it now. Let's see what happens. And so then on election night, Bexar County, which is where he's from, it's San Antonio. the early returns come in first. And we are far exceeding what our numbers are. And it looks like, boom, we're into the runoff, no problem. You know, if we're hitting this, we're hitting our early vote benchmarks and some other places, we're in good shape. And then the election day vote comes in. And it was clear that that ad had just taken, you know, 250, it was a pretty healthy radio buy, but 250 grand in radio. It's clear the effect that it had on the election day vote. So we end up missing the runoff by about 1,000 votes. Obviously, Chip goes on and wins the runoff pretty narrowly, but now it has been in Congress as the rabble rouser. So that is just because I was so close with him, that's one that I always remember. And it's, you know, it's such a good lesson that to vet, you know, self-oppo as much as you can. And or as I say, hey, if you really want to run for something, just never be on social media because something will always come back and bite you.
You know, a funny story. So a couple of years ago, we were pitching a pretty high profile candidate, U.S. Senate candidate. And I went through to all my staff, all the leaders on the firm said, make sure you go through and check all your tweets to make sure you never said anything about this person. I had to clean up some of my tweets. Phil had to clean up some of his tweets. But Phil, and nor I, we didn't think about it. We didn't check our replies or our likes. And Phil had made a couple comments in the reply section. And we learned our lesson that as digital guys, we didn't even think about it because you're just looking at what did you proactively say. You're not thinking about the comments on Facebook or your replies or your likes. So, right. You know, I guess this was like 4 years ago now, probably. But now we've learned, and we tell that to all of our candidates when we're going through. And because, you know, we're not opposition guys, but to your point about self-opposition, because of the digital guys, we often get tasked with cleansing social media profiles and going through and reviewing what they've put out there. And now we have to make sure that we're not only looking at the post, but we're also looking at the comments and the likes too.
Well, that's why I'm always careful. You get calls from reporters all the time. It's like, oh, what do you think about this, Dad? And I'm like, you know what? I've learned over the years that I don't play Monday morning quarterback because if I'm out there criticizing some consultant, look, it's probably someone that I'm going to end up needing to work with one day. So it doesn't do me any good 100%. To be like, oh, that ad sucked, or hey, I wouldn't have done that. It's like, you know, I'm not going to sit here and criticize other people's tactics because it doesn't do me any good.
No, that's exactly right, dude. And that's why I deleted my Twitter account a few years ago. And I'm mostly only on Instagram. And that's mostly just my running.
You're smarter than me.
I very rarely put up anything political these days. I put up something this weekend about Nikki Haley putting bumper stickers on stop signs, but you know, around town. But besides that, I just try to stay away. The other comment that what I thought was interesting to your point, the very first thing you said is about, you know, this is one of the first times you had a friend running. And this is this trend that I noticed really over the last 2 years as I get older, that just so many of my colleagues that I went to college with or my neighbor, like people that I personally know or friends with, are coming to me and asking me to run their races. You know, like Nancy Mace was a friend of mine well before she became a congresswoman and started stirring up shit everywhere. I got tons of friends who are now running for state house, running for council, running for Senate. So it's weird that we're at that age now. I still haven't accepted that I'm old yet. But right. We're now at that age where like our actual colleagues are running for office.
Right. And if you're anything like me, you want to tell them, no, you don't want to do that.
Yeah. Like, what the hell are you doing?
Right.
Well, you know, lastly, let me ask, what is your advice for someone who might want to get into the polling side of politics?
You know, I think if you want to get into really whether it's polling or digital or any aspect of the consultant class, so to speak, as lame as that term is, I really think the best thing you can do is go work on a campaign. You know, whether you're a volunteer while you're in college, I just think the experience of that is so important. And frankly, it's so helpful because look, we work people pretty hard. You know, I know you guys have pushed you as well. But if you have the experience on the campaign, guess what? We're not going to work you any harder than you got worked on the campaign, right? We do let you, you know, you get a day off every once in a while here, even during the election cycle. Whereas a campaign, it is 24/7. I mean, it's you're working from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. And I think that is one of the reasons, as much as it sucked to lose that first campaign I was on, I'm so glad I did it because it made it where I think such an element of my success because I learned that you have to work hard in politics. As I say, no matter how hard they worked me, that first cycle of POS, at least I was getting paid, which I wasn't. Yeah. You know, I was lucky that it was a big congressional district, because whenever someone had to drive, I'd be like, oh, I'll drive, because I wanted to get the gas reimbursement, right? Because that was how I could make a little money, is getting reimbursed for my gas mileage. So that is that was just such a valuable experience to me. And the people that I've hired, the most successful people that I've hired almost to a person, that have worked on a campaign, because look, it shows they have a passion for what we do, and it really instills on you a really good work ethic.
Yeah, dude, you're 100% right. You know, we get a lot of people that apply at our company, and if you volunteered or worked on a campaign, you're getting put on the top of the pile. And if you worked on a campaign and bartended or waited tables,
we love people who worked in college or who were athletes in college. We're like, okay, you have to manage your time.
Yeah, you know, you've got a good work ethic, you got to manage your time. If you waited tables, then you know how to multitask, and you're great with people and customer service. But no, I 100% agree with you, man. But look, I really appreciate you taking the time today. This has been awesome.
Yeah, definitely. No, it was great to join. Like I said, I'm a fan of the pod, so it was an honor to get to be on it myself.
All right. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, bud.
Thank you for listening to Campaign War Stories. Please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get new episodes sent straight to your inbox by subscribing at wesleydonahue.com. I hope you have a phenomenal day full of positive vibes.